Welcome to another episode of Pandemic Parenting with Pep, a podcast designed to help parents thrive, not just survive, this extra stressful period of parenting through the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm your host, Robbie Fox, Certified Parent Educator with the Parent Encouragement Program, or PEP as it's commonly known. PEP has been providing proven positive parenting education for nearly 40 years through in-person and online classes, and more recently has been offering free webinars and other resources to parents and caregivers struggling with life's current demands and stresses. You can access all of these resources through PEP's website at pepparent.org. In this episode of the podcast, I talk with Andrew Reiner, author of a new book entitled Better Boys, Better Men, The New Masculinity That Creates Greater Courage and Emotional Resiliency. This book takes a close look at how our society's toxic masculine expectations actually harm boys and men and may be contributing to the current increase in levels of depression and episodes of violence among males in our country. In this podcast, I talk with Andrew about ways that parents of sons might encourage improved communication to help boys and men develop the emotional intelligence they need to live more authentic, connected lives. In addition to being an author, Andrew teaches at Towson University, where he offers the seminar Changing Face of Masculinity. He has written or been featured in articles on masculinity and men's issues for the New York Times, the Washington Post Magazine, Men's Health Magazine, Forbes, and NPR. Andrew, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Me too. Thank you for having me, Robbie. I really appreciate it.
So tell me a little bit about how you got into sort of this field in terms of talking about raising better men and just the idea of sort of defining what masculinity has been and is today.
Sure. So, I mean, you know, I've got a long tale that I'll try to really kind of conflate here. There's a long story here, but the bottom line is, I was always a very sensitive boy, big feelings, which I didn't realize until I was much older. But basically a lot of this started for me when I was about 7 years old, and I got into this brutal fist fight with this boy in the neighborhood. And in the eyes of a lot of the other boys who were watching, he just completely humiliated me. And so when I got home eventually later that day, so I heard my oldest brother screaming at my mother, just saying, you know, what a coward and a black sheep I was, and what an embarrassment and a coward. And so that really kind of began in my family from that oldest brother. It really began a smear campaign. And so in his mind, I was a coward literally well into adulthood, and he never let me live that down. Even he thought it was a big joke. But you know, that kind of thing on anybody, you know, is going to have a devastating effect, especially when you're yes. young and you don't have parents that are stepping in and saying, you know what, cut it out, you're wrong. Mm-hmm. And this is not the kind of behavior we want to encourage. And, you know, everything you're saying is way out of line. They never really stepped in and really corrected the situation at all. And so, as a result, I started just really spending a lot of my childhood, and this happened a lot at school. I was basically trying to fight my way out of the shame. And so when I finally did stop fighting, which was in about sixth grade, I remember there was this one moment where I was in the middle of a fight, and I was just kind of, I never liked fighting, but I did it because I felt like it was basically redeeming me. Mm-hmm. And I just got this moment where I remember I just was feeling really nauseous, you know, at the feeling of hitting this other boy in the jaw with my fist. And so when I finally put my fist down, it kind of, you know, the lack of action of feeling like I had to prove myself opened up this giant consciousness in me. It was a consciousness that really just continued for the rest of, you know, my childhood, adolescence, into adulthood, of just expanding the awareness and understanding of just the ways that boys talk to each other and treat each other. Mm-hmm. And so increasingly that was really something on my radar. And so I've just really spent, it was like my own little crusade of finding ways to push back against what I thought was just a really unhealthy way of being a boy and eventually being a man. Mm-hmm. And so this stuff, you know, increasingly was on my radar, you know, throughout adolescence into adulthood. And so I started teaching, when I was teaching at the university where I teach, Towson University, I started teaching the Honors College. And the head of the Honors College at the time was looking for new seminars. And she asked if I had any ideas. And I said, well, as a matter of fact, you know, I do have an idea, you know, about this, what it means to be a man in this culture. Mm-hmm. And so I came up with this title, The Changing Face of Masculinity. Mm-hmm. And really it was this idea of what I really hoped would be a changing face of masculinity that I wanted to talk about with the students. And so at the end of the semester, I remember I've been teaching it maybe two semesters, and one of the students came up to me who had taught it, and she and I had a good rapport. And she said, you know, what is the deal with you and this vulnerability thing? And I said, what are you talking about? She said, you're always like kind of pushing so much about this idea of vulnerability in this course. And to be honest, I wasn't even conscious of that. And so I just kind of stepped back and I looked at what it was that I really hoped the students were taking away from it. Mm-hmm. And what I realized was that I was slowly coming to this kind of reckoning that the thing that I really felt that boys and men needed moving forward was a greater degree of self-awareness that included a far greater degree of emotional honesty. Mm-hmm. And this was something that there was kind of, another reckoning that I had when my son was born 9 years ago. And when my son was born, it was just kind of this huge, just bucket of cold water in my face. Whereas before it had always been my own personal crusade, mm-hmm. you know, about pushing back against what I felt like was a very unhealthy form of masculinity and what I thought maybe, you know, boys and men needed. And it really forced me to really think a lot more clearly and a lot more, the stakes felt higher. Mm-hmm. And I had to really sit down and think, it's no longer just my crusade. What does it mean now that I've got a boy and a burgeoning, ultimately, hopefully, a burgeoning man in my care? You know, what is that going to mean? And so things just started crystallizing. You know, it was very much a kind of really kind of a third reckoning for me after, you know, the growing consciousness of a boy, teaching the course, and then having a son. It was all kind of this trilogy for me. And so it forced me to really look long and hard. And the thing that I realized was that it wasn't just about being a sensitive male. It had to encompass a lot more than that. It had to also encompass this. I really came to believe that the way for boys and men to start really kind of liberating themselves from a very unhealthy masculinity that was still being encouraged, it had to start at core with a degree of emotional honesty and self-awareness.
And to have that, you have to have some vulnerability.
Well, you do. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And so, you know, I realized in the course of researching my book that, you know, I was already at a place with this thing of vulnerability that I've been leaning into it for a long time. And what I came to realize by interviewing, you know, a lot of boys and men was that, you know, everybody, of course, has to do it in ways that they can do it that feels comfortable and safe. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my expectation of this idea of vulnerability and emotional honesty, you know, was different for a lot of these boys and men. And what I realized was that it could definitely look different. The important thing was that we meet boys and men where they are and that they come to feel that there's a safe space where they can learn to do this, where they feel that they've got permission. Because those are two really important things when it comes to helping boys and men access their deeper feelings. It's got to be feel like a safe space, and they have to feel like there are people they trust and that they respect who are giving them permission.
You know, it's interesting you talk about the seminar on masculinity. I can remember in college there being women's studies programs and gender studies and, you know, sexual education, but not anything on masculinity. Is that sort of right. Just a whole new, that was a new topic, so to speak.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, the awareness of it really did begin in the 70s. You know, it really did coincide, you know, with the second rise of feminism. But it was a very small movement. You know, it was, you know, thankfully in the 70s, we had, you know, the second rise of feminism. We had Black Power. We had, the birth of gay rights. Thankfully, all those things, you know, were coming into play. And so there was a small minority of, you know, of especially college-aged, you know, young men in college who were looking at these things, but it was a very, very small movement. Mm-hmm. And it really didn't, you know, really pick up steam until probably the 80s with the men's movement.
So how do you describe or define the new masculinity that you talk about in your book?
Yeah, so the new masculinity absolutely encompasses, you know, a degree of sensitivity, but it's not just about, you know, it's not just about being a sensitive and gentle man. You know, a lot of times I get older men saying, oh, I'm a gentle man, and so this is what we need. There is a degree of gentleness, absolutely, but it doesn't be, that's not the alpha and the omega. There is, you know, we live in a time where boys and men, there's a toolkit that they need to thrive, and in the increasing, you know, they're at the fore of the epidemics of suicide and loneliness. Mm-hmm. So it's not just that, you know, they need this toolkit to thrive, they need it to survive. And so, you know, the toolkit encompasses things like a degree of sensitivity, but it's more than that. It's that, and it's much more than that. It's far greater degree of self-awareness, mm-hmm. empathy, collaboration, greater communication skills, both from within and from without. These are all skills, you know, that girls and women do so well. And these are reasons that they are thriving in, mm-hmm. in the classroom and the workplace. We're really kind of slow in the uptake with getting boys and young men ready with these same skills, because this is what they need to thrive and survive. Mm-hmm. So these are absolutely essential skills that they need. But they're also skills on a personal, intrapersonal level that they need with themselves, because it will help them to learn to access and process and externalize so many of the deeper feelings and emotions that they struggle with, that they don't feel they have permission to really face head on and to externalize. Mm-hmm. And that's a large reason why, when I talked about boys and men surviving, it's such a to a large extent, it's what's driving the spikes in anxiety, depression, loneliness, social, emotional, and social isolation, and suicide in boys and men.
Right, that which is definitely on the rise. So how can parents talk with boys and check in with how they're feeling and give them the space to really be able to connect and emote in ways that, you know, perhaps their sisters or the other women in their lives are able to do?
Right. So, you know, a couple things. One of the places we have to start really is on the shoulders of the parents, the places to start. And what I mean by that is this: we have to model emotional honesty in our, you know, it has to start with us. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that a lot of boys and young men still believe deep down is that talking about these kinds of things the way that, say, their sisters do, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. feels to them, even though they may, you know, be very enlightened boys and young men, it still feels to them as if they are being incompetent as burgeoning men if they are talking about these things. Because one of the things we always need to remember is that, and this was borne out endlessly in the interviews I did for my book, so many boys and young men talked about, you know, no matter how many ways they were so open-minded and progressive in their thoughts about gender equality and about sensitive, you know, being a sensitive male, so many of them really kind of dropped off when it came to the idea of their deeper emotional lives and what was okay to talk about and what was okay to share, and what was okay to get help for, because they do feel still, a lot of boys and men, as if this is one thing that will hold them back from being a competent male. They still feel like they've got to do it themselves. Mm-hmm. And so that said, if we understand that, we have to start giving boys and men permission. And it's not, and if we haven't been doing it all along to talk with them this way in the household, then at the very least, what we need to start doing is starting to model for them this kind of talk and this kind of way of thinking about emotional honesty. It's got to start with us. We have to be modeling it. Mm-hmm. And so if we're not doing it with boys at a young age where it becomes normalized for them, it's going to feel very abrupt, and very scary to them. You know, mm-hmm. it's yet one more thing that we're forcing on them. Right. So it's got to, we've got to be more subtle, but we have to model it. And one of the things that we also have to do is help boys and young men understand that, you know, this is about their health and their well-being. This is, you know, this idea of some kind of behavior that encourages well-being being something that's feminine, we need to work to really erode that. We completely need to work to erode that. And that's part of this idea that I talk about in the book of the new masculinity. We've got to stop thinking of a healthier form of being a boy and a man as being feminine. If there's being anything feminine about that. Mm-hmm. We've got to learn, find ways to take that off the table. But in terms of, you know, looking for ways that we can start to get boys to talk about these things, we have to, as I said, we have to be modeling it for them. We have to be normalizing these thoughts and these feelings. And, you know, even if we can't get them to be talking about it with us, the more that we normalize it with them, the more on a very subtle level, they will feel permission. With my 9-year-old boy, when I get really worked up, you know, I'm a guy with big feelings too. Mm-hmm. I am what I am. This is the way I'm wired. And this is what I have to deal with. So when I'm feeling things and I maybe overreact and he hears me, I will go back to him and I will say, whether it was, you know, a reaction directed at him or he overheard me, you know, talking with his mother, mm-hmm. my wife, I will go back and say to him, you just heard the way I reacted, right? Again, whether it was directed at him or not, let me tell you what was really beneath the anger or the frustration you heard. Mm-hmm. I was scared. I was frustrated. My feelings were hurt. So what I'm doing is I'm trying to go back and model for him what it was that was really beneath the reaction that he saw in me. Mm-hmm. And I also will say to him, you know what? Just like we're working on these big feelings with you, these are things that grownups have to work on sometimes too as well. He doesn't know this, but what I'm doing is I'm modeling this behavior for him.
My work on the National Suicide Prevention Hotline and chat line, primarily on the chat line, but also some on the phones, I'd say it's at least 50% young males, adolescent, young adult males that are struggling with not having anybody they feel like they can talk to. Of those, I'd say, you know, 50 to 75% may have just undergone the breakup of a significant relationship and get the sense that that was the one and only person they really felt that they could show themselves to. And now that person's gone and they feel like they have no one. They can't, you know, when you try to explore who else is in their network, and, you know, the adolescent males, no, I can't talk to my parents about this. I can't, you know, I can't. And, you know, eventually sometimes you can get them to kind of agree to write them a letter, or, you know, my parents wouldn't let me see a therapist. They'd freak out if I asked it, if I could see a therapist. There's just still a lot of that fear that these boys and young men are sensing in their parents. Is that something that you saw when you were researching, you know, the book, and what are messages we can say to them about how they can approach their parents?
Yes, it was across the board. That was my experience as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I had so many boys that were, you know, they were obviously sensitive, thoughtful boys and young men, high school age, college age, and in their 20s. And yet, when it came to as I was saying earlier, when it came to their deeper emotional lives and their willingness to get the help that they needed, they were still stuck in a kind of old static masculine norm that isn't serving them or serving the rest of us. I would interview so many boys and young men and say to them, so what does your emotional support network look like? Oh, I've got a great social support network. Okay, what does that look like? Oh, I've got this friend and I've got this friend. And when I've got problems, I can go to them. What do they tell you? They give me great advice. Okay, that's great. They give you great advice. Who do you talk to them when you really need to do like an emotional dump? Do you talk to them? Mm-hmm. No. Who do you talk to? I've got this girlfriend.
Right.
I've got this friend who's a girl. I've got this girlfriend. You know, right. Once in a while they talk to their mothers. Okay, well, so what it really was, and I started to call, I came up for a label for this. I call it targeted transparency in the book. Boys will share, and the middle-aged men were doing the same thing with their friends. Mm-hmm. There are certain things they will share with male friends. They're mm-hmm. very carefully vetted. Mm-hmm. They're not everything that they'll share with them. There's certain things they feel like they won't be judged or rejected for, and they often will get solutions or advice. But it's the same thing that you're finding with these boys and young men who are calling in for this hotline. You know, they will still turn to females across the board when they really need to find the emotional support that they need, because they know that that is the lingua franca of females, and that is a safe space for them. Mm-hmm. And boys and men need this. And the way, again, the way that we can get them more comfortable with this and get them on board with this is by normalizing this kind of talk in the household. This is the safest space to start it with.
Right.
And it is a huge, huge problem, because not just because of course we know that you know men will not seek out help when they need it, but because what that speaks to is that we are still perpetuating and allowing boys to perpetuate a type of bonding with each other that discourages emotional trust. Mm-hmm. And that is why they will turn to females, because that is a place where they can have emotional trust. And my God, how staggering is that? Mm-hmm. That boys still have friendships and young men still have friendships, where they have to look outside of that network to get the deeper support that they need, because they don't feel that they can say it in front of their guy friends, because they'll be judged, they'll be rejected, and they will. And another thing a lot of them often said was, "I don't want to burden them. I don't want to impose right. that on them." And you know what? Yes. There's truth to that. There is truth to that, because their friends will say, and I had boys and I had middle-aged men saying, sometimes my friends will say, you know, they'll change the subject. They don't want to talk about it. There is truth to that. Right. And so this is an emotional safety net that is absolutely crucial, that we need to really change the way that we need to change the infrastructure. We need to help boys change the infrastructure of their friendships. We really do.
Right. Yes. No, but what you mentioned, I get that a lot too. Say, oh, I don't want to bother my parents, or I don't want to burden them, or they're dealing with so much already.
Right. I didn't address that about the parents. So a lot of boys wouldn't talk to parents when they're younger, like say elementary school, middle school, they might go and talk to parents. And usually more often than not, you know, it was the mom. Occasionally it was the dad. Mm-hmm. More often than not, it was the mom. But by the time these boys are entering into that transitional hinge time in high school, they're very much telling me, I can't talk to my parents. My parents don't necessarily want me coming to them, because they want me to learn to take things on myself. And that speaks to this idea of, we are preparing you to be a quote unquote competent man. And that means you've got to handle things on your own. And that is a dynamic right there. Again, talk about staggering. That is a huge setup for a lot of potential mental health problems for boys and young men going forward.
Years ago, I read a book, Boys Adrift, by Leonard Sachs, and it was sort of talking about in the education space more, how boys were sort of falling behind, or males in general were falling behind their female counterparts. And part of it was because when they start kindergarten, they are socially, emotionally, developmentally a little bit behind their female peers. I mean, that's just how, you know, females and males do track differently developmentally. And so when they start off in kindergarten, they're kind of behind already. They sort of like, you know, pull back and in some ways. And then I was talking also about video games, how that was one area that boys felt like they could show their power or really be capable. And so there'd be this heightened activity to video games because it's one space where they could go to and feel like they were in control and had some power and were capable or as capable as some of their peers. Do you think any of that kind of factors into this too? Just that we're asking our young boys to be perhaps more advanced in ways that they aren't starting off in school, in the school system?
You know, I don't think so. I really don't. I think that what happens is that a lot of boys, and there is some research that bears this out, a lot of boys emotionally and their ability to recognize emotions facially in other kids, for a lot of them, it keeps step with girls up mm-hmm. until about kindergarten. And you mentioned kindergarten, and kindergarten is it very much a hinge time where a lot of boys in schools are often starting to get messages from peers that really fit in with this kind of traditional masculine norms, the script. Mm-hmm. That is really where this consciousness really, really becomes, believe it or not, it does really happen that young, usually in kindergarten. And if not by kindergarten, always by the beginning of elementary school, they're starting to get messages from peers, both boys mm-hmm. and girls. Mm-hmm. And so I really do believe, you know, from the research I've seen and just in the experiences as a parent, that boys really are capable on an emotional level and on a recognition level with facial expressions. And I think what happens is that I really think that so much about the script that we teach boys and that we impose upon them really, really kind of changes their consciousness in terms of what they should be focusing on and what they shouldn't really be focusing on. In terms of the development, the tracking you talked about, you know, in my book, the one thing that I talk about that's a neurological difference is the right hemisphere of the brain. Because in utero and, you know, during early adolescence, the male, you know, brain is flooded with testosterone. Mm-hmm. And during those formative stages of, you know, the secondary growth of, you know, of the growth of the secondary sexual characteristics, those are pivotal stages. And that's when the brain is flooded. And that does inhibit the growth of, you know, the right hemisphere of the brain, which has to do with emotional regulation. And some people do believe that there's also some things with language development. But there's been a lot of research in the past couple of years that talks about, and I talk about this in a chapter of my book, about the wiring of men, boys and men, is that there's a mosaic of brain structural features that is far more similar in males and females, people who identify as male and female, then they're far more similar than they are different. That 98% of the structural, there's structural similarities that are 98% in all brains. And that sometimes there are brains that have more kind of seemingly, you know, feminine structures, sometimes, you know, what we think of as male, you know, male structures. But the work of, I think her name is Daphna Joel, she's done some groundbreaking work on what is the mosaic of the human brain, that it is far more similar in everybody, regardless of gender orientation, than mm-hmm. it is different. The other thing about things like testosterone is that, you know, that raises and lowers testosterone based on when males feel threatened. And there's been, I talk about this fascinating research that's been done on that, is that most of the levels of male testosterone rise and fall depending on the extent to which males feel threatened with status. So when we talk about this idea of tracking, I really don't buy into this notion that men are from Mars and women are from Venus at all. I think that there are some differences in the right hemisphere of the brain, and that does make boys more susceptible to emotional reactivity. Talk a lot about that in the book. But boys can and do catch up with language eventually. But I really don't buy this idea that men are from Mars and women are from Venus. I really do think, and I talk a lot about this in my book, that a lot of this does begin in terms of scripting and socialized messages that happen more so in kindergarten, early elementary school.
So it's more environmental than it is biological and physiological.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And you know, a lot of the more and more of the research is showing that all the time. You know, I cite in my book a great article in Scientific American, you know, where they came out with what I thought was a really brave, you know, strong piece about, you know, about human brains and the mosaic of the human brain, and that more and more of this really is far more socialized than it is neurological.
I really love how you talked about, you know, we define the sensitive man, and it's in the commercials about the father wearing his the tutu and sitting down and having a tea party with his daughter. But what is he doing to demonstrate that sensitive side to his son?
That's right. That's right. And that's something, you know, that is another kind of blind spot. I feel like a lot of dads are doing fantastic work around their daughters. I think so many fathers have really, really stepped up and have really done a great job of opening their eyes and their hearts to their daughters in ways that their daughters need it, but they're not doing it with their sons. You know, I just came across on Instagram this meme the other day of where you see, you know, basically it's encouraging, you know, fathers to be better dads. And you see, you know, they're encouraging, you know, closeness with the sons. And there's a photograph of a father's fist and a baby, what we assume to be a son's fist, coming up against each other. So they're basically fist bumping. And so if you look at a lot of commercials, you know, with or memes on social media, it's fathers still, you know, opening up. And I think that this is really speaks to the macro dynamic that's at play here. We have done finally a great job of giving girls and young women an endless spectrum on which to choose their own identity, as well we should. But when you look at boys, there are still, when you look at these social media memes and these commercials, Robbie, there are still so many stereotypical ways that fathers are bonding with sons. You know, the fist bumping. You know, occasionally you'll see a hug. You'll see them wrestling together. You know, what you don't see is these fathers, you know, putting on tutus and dancing with their sons. I'm not saying they have to wear tutus, but I'm saying the idea is what if their sons, that want to have a more gender fluid identity. Right. You know, you don't see fathers in these memes or TV commercials doing that. We don't see the father painting their son's nails.
Right. We make sure they're out in the backyard playing ball with their daughters.
Right. Exactly. Exactly right. We see a great job of expanding the opportunities for daughters, but we still see this very limited script that we're still encouraging fathers to bond with and really trying to connect with their sons. You know, there was a great study that I mentioned in my book, which talks about how, which talks very much about this, and how so many boys, when you ask them, you know, what are the expectations that you're told by your parents and by other adults and teachers, what are the expectations for being a man? And the expectations for being a man, so many boys spoke to, was that they had to be tough. They had to be willing to throw a punch if their masculinity was threatened or challenged. And there were a lot of other things. And when they said, well, what is it that you want to be thought of? I want to be thought of as kind, as smart, as helpful. And that I want to be able to talk about, you know, I want to be able to, you know, to talk about my feelings without being judged.
Right.
I mean, the boys saw through it. This is what I mean about boys really can see through, you know, the insincerity. They do a great job of it. And they could see that the expectations that were being foisted on them versus what they really hoped for deep down for themselves, there was a polarity there.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I talked to two different male friends, was talking about, you know, getting ready to interview you, and, you know, talking about the book and about how it was getting males to open up and talk and feelings, and both of them, separate conversation, goes, I don't know what you're talking about.
Like, you know, there you go.
How about the game? You know, I was just like, I don't know what you're talking about. And just immediately, like, and then they, you know, they said they were doing it to be funny, but I was like, no, that's just kind of what's normal in our society. So what we're dealing with today in our world, the pandemic, how has that impacted boys, especially in terms of their mental health and how they're feeling?
Right. So we know, of course, you know, that kids of all gender orientations are suffering, you know, with anxiety and depression and the isolation, the emotional isolation. Mm-hmm. The difference with boys is that because they are still stuck in that vestige of hypermasculinity, of feeling that they've got to handle everything on their own, and they should mm-hmm. be able to handle everything on their own, that right there is a huge stopgap in terms of them being willing to do what girls and young women are doing a great job of doing, which is reaching out and saying, I need to talk. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't always necessarily even mean, you know, having to get professional counseling or therapy, which is fantastic if they do. But it means that they will turn to a friend, they will turn to a mother, you know, they will turn to, you know, other females, and they will just vent and they will support each other. And so that is something that if you're not seeing, you know, if you know, boys aren't doing that as much, you know, they're talking and they're gaming together as they always have, right?
Right.
But they're not, you know, and because they're not physically in school as much, you know, with girls who are friends, you know, or girlfriends, there's not as much of that kind of, you know, rubbing shoulders and talking with them about these things. Because one of the things, of course, that we talked about, you know, boys don't want to do is they don't want to feel like they're burdening anybody. And mm-hmm. so if they're not, you know, in school, say with their females who are friends, and talking in school about these things, they're not going to be as likely to reach out and say, hey, I need to talk. Right. Because that's an extra layer of vulnerability that's going to make them feel more incompetent. Mm-hmm. And so the other thing that I think is really important to know, and I do talk about this quite a bit in my book, is that the levels of anxiety and depression, there's far greater parity there than I think we realize or we want to realize. So the research still shows that girls do experience anxiety at greater levels than boys do. But I really do think that we're not really seeing, I really do think that A, there hasn't been enough research when it comes to anxiety in boys. Because one of the things is that a lot of boys by a certain age understand that even if it's anonymous, they don't want to admit to themselves that they are anxious. And I think that there needs to be far greater degrees of checking in on anxiety with levels of boys, because I think that boys are experiencing it, you know, at comparable levels as girls today, or if not comparable, pretty close to. Mm-hmm. Depression, we tend to think of girls experiencing it in women 2-to-1 to boys and men. But there's been research in the past few years that shows that a lot of the yardsticks and the metrics that have been used to gauge depression have been ones that work effectively for girls and women. So for instance, you're looking at things like ennui, you know, at lethargy, at feeling, very kind of sad and very kind of, you know, removing yourself and not really talking much. Excuse me. There are boys and young men who may experience it that way. Mm-hmm. But some of the more common ways that boys experience and young men experience depression is far greater irritability, is lashing out much more quickly, mm-hmm. is leaning into more risky behaviors. Mm-hmm. And so it's also leaning into behaviors that aren't risky, but that are sanctioned. Things like spending a lot more time at the gym, working out a lot harder and a lot more frequently. If it's men leaning into their work and spending a lot more time at their jobs, these are sanctioned ways of being a male, right? that are mm-hmm. that you get validation for. And it's right. a very convenient way to kind of try to, you know, to try to really, you know, push back on the depression you may not even be realizing that you're experiencing.
Staying engaged in life, but not engaging in the emotion.
That's exactly right.
And connectivity with people.
Because you're
high functioning, basically. But
that's a good way to put it, Robbie. And it's also sanctioned, because these are ways, right. you know, it's about being in action, which is a very typically sanctioned male response. As right. long as you're in action and it appears to be something that you'll get validation for, then, you know, that's a very convenient way to sweep the deeper struggles under the rug. But what happened is that when they would alter the metrics that better reflected the ways that depression can often manifest in boys and men, and when they implemented those two yardsticks so that it could appeal to boys and men who might experience it in a way that might appear more stereotypically feminine, and when it also accounted for boys and men who are depressed in ways that look different, mm-hmm. the gap was almost comparable. There was a great study in the Journal of American Medical Association that had gauged this. And there was also, I was really glad to see this, a website for continuing education for, I think, therapists. And they talked about the need to start using this other metric that better mm-hmm. recognizes depression in boys and men, because we're missing that.
Well, how do you approach those that you feel are over-engaged in working out or, you know, work or, you know, how do you go about, if you sense that's what's going on, they would be in complete denial about it, right? So how do you even approach them?
They absolutely would. Yeah, they absolutely would. I mean, you know, we know that boys and men are going to get defensive, you know, mm-hmm. when this topic of feelings comes up. But one of the things that, you know, there's no easy way to do this, you know, and with boys and men, you know, if they are boys and men who really don't feel comfortable typically talking about these kinds of feelings, we have to find ways to meet them where they are, you know, mm-hmm. and so, you know, there have to be ways to create these safe spaces where we can have conversations, you know, where maybe what you can do is sometimes make the connections, help them make the connections for them. You know, talk about the behavior that they're doing. You know, I've noticed that you're going to the gym a lot more. I noticed that you're spending a lot more time working out. Why is that? You know, why do you think you're doing that? Mm-hmm. You know, I was in the car with you. You were driving a couple of days ago, and man, you were driving really fast. You know, and you seemed a lot more irritable than usual in the car. You know, what was behind that? Because, mm-hmm. you know, one of the things that we want to show boys and men is that we support them, and that we're concerned about them, and that we want to show them that it is safe. We want to try to create this environment that it's safe, you know, where they can talk about these kinds of things. But again, it's, you know, I think the place to start is by talking about what we observe, mm-hmm. and to try to ask them, you know, what it was that was beneath that kind of the action itself. And, you know, we can only probe so much. You know, we can say right. things like, okay, well, but can you see how this behavior is kind of getting to be a bit extreme?
So you've offered some great tips on kind of approaching the conversation. I think my biggest takeaway, and certainly the biggest takeaway from your book too, is just awareness of this situation, awareness of this dynamic that we have kind of allowed to perpetuate in society, and aware of the damage we're doing long-term perhaps. And then you mentioned some specific, you know, steps of things to do in terms of getting curious, you know, asking questions about what's behind it, empathy, and really just allowing the space, allowing the room for boys to emote and to understand that that's okay, both mothers and fathers.
Absolutely.
Right. So that's, but I think just awareness of this, we've got so many things going on in our society right now with, and you mentioned, you know, earlier, we've got the Black Lives Matters, very important. We've got civil rights for people of different sexual and gender identities, again, very important. So lots of I don't want to say causes, because they're more than causes.
Movements,
right. But we also still need to be conscious of not putting our males of any gender or sexual identity or racial identity in a box.
And that, to be honest, I think that there is some pushback when it comes to this topic. I think that we think that, okay, well, you know, males and especially white males are doing fine, thank you. You know, this is not their time. They need to step back. They need to deal with things themselves if they have any problems. You know, other groups need to come to the fore. And of course, there is an awareness and a consciousness that needs to be raised, you know, with gender equality, you know, with Black Lives Matter, you know, with other gender orientations, you know, needing to find ways to feel safe and supported, mm-hmm. absolutely on all fronts. Mm-hmm. And that said, there is a crisis, whether we want to admit it or not, and a crisis is a crisis. A crisis doesn't know gender. Crisis doesn't know race. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the reality is that there are a lot of boys and young men and middle-aged men who are suffering. Mm-hmm. And so they're really, we are at this place of a reckoning right now. And, you know, we don't have to, there doesn't have to be, you know, this big macro movement necessarily, because it can happen on a micro level in our homes.
Right.
And that's the important thing we need to understand, is that, you know, just because there are, you know, these other movements that are extremely important and extremely viable that need to occur, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean that we can just kind of brush aside the needs, in this case, of boys and men, because the reality is that they still, you talked earlier about the lagging behind in school, they still are lagging behind in school. I talk a lot about that in my book. Mm-hmm. They're lagging behind in the classroom and the workplace. Mm-hmm. And if you don't even want to look at that, then what we need to look at that's far more urgent are the levels of anxiety, depression, despair, emotional isolation and loneliness, and then in turn, suicide. You know, there are far more, the age at which a lot of the suicides are starting to happen, and especially in boys, is being dropped down to 10.
Yes, I've
been dropped down to 10 years old. We only have so much wiggle room to play with here. At some point, we do have to recognize that it's not a coincidence that the one thing that we are seeing is a failure to thrive and survive in boys and young men. There really is an epidemic, at the crisis, the very least, in this area. And this is something that needs attention, and it absolutely positively can begin with the way that we, the ways that we, you know, talk to and don't talk to boys.
Right, right. And we'll wrap it up there. The book again is Better Boys, Better Men, The New Masculinity That Creates Greater Courage and Emotional Resiliency by Andrew Reiner. And Andrew, I just want to ask you I like to ask this of each of the guests on the podcast. Other than your book, Better Boys, Better Men, what's your favorite parenting book?
Mm-hmm. A book that has really inspired and influenced me tremendously is a book out of the 90s, Raising Cain, mm-hmm. which for my money in terms of raising boys is still a book that stands up. And I think that's a really important book. In fact, it was very much an influence for me on many levels in terms of what I wanted to do with my book. So that book for me was defining, Raising Cain.
Okay. What's your favorite parenting tip?
My favorite parenting tip, there's a lot of them. Let me come up with one. And this is one that, I'm going to go back to what I said earlier. Mm-hmm. The importance of normalizing emotional honesty in our homes. The importance of taking away, completely puncturing all the huge balloon of fear that we place around feelings and emotions. And I think it's so important that we normalize emotional honesty in our homes.
And what do you enjoy to do for family fun?
So one of the things I miss doing that I love that we did a lot is there's a park near where we live, and there's a little lake with a sandy beach, and we would go there and we would have dinner there in the evening, and we'd play wiffle ball on the beach. That was a great one. I miss that so much.
Yes. Yes. Well, hopefully we'll get back to those times. So Andrew, again, thank you so much for your time. And I encourage those listening to get the book and start those conversations that we so desperately need to have with the young males in our lives.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Robbie. It's been wonderful.
Thank you. You can find Andrew's book, Better Boys, Better Men, through your favorite bookstore, and can follow Andrew on Instagram at andrew.reiner.author. That's andrew.reiner.author. Remember, too, that there are hundreds of resources on PEP's website, pepparent.org, including details on PEP's upcoming live online programs, on-demand videos, blog posts, and many other resources as parents face the challenges of pandemic parenting on top of the ones of everyday parent and wife. If you like what you're hearing on these podcasts, please share them with your friends and family. Thank you for joining us. I'm Robbie Fox with the Parent Encouragement Program, reminding each of us that it takes courage to be imperfect, especially when it comes to parenting.